from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. According to the IRS, waiting to file until the last minute increases the odds of making mistakes. Well, April 15th is just 2 weeks from Monday, and many of us still haven't filed. So in the hour ahead, we've asked two tax experts to join us to answer your questions. Wondering about whether refinancing costs are deductible? What about the costs of higher education or moving expenses to take a new job? If you're about to retire, do you know if your Social Security benefits will be taxable? Pull out your tax file, figure out your top questions, and join us for our next hour of Forum as we take all of your tax questions after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. April 15th is just around the corner. So this is a program that can be introduced with two words and a phone number, as in tax questions, 866-733-6786. That is all we are going to do for the next hour, which is answer your tax questions. So you can join us right now at 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions to us at forum@kqed.org, or you can post your questions on our website or on our Facebook page. Joining us to provide answers to all of your tax questions, Bob Kaplan, CPA from Foster City and a member of the California Society of CPAs Tax Committee. Bob Kaplan, good morning.
Good morning.
And joining us, too, is Jesse Weller. He is the spokesperson in the Bay Area for the IRS. Jesse Weller, good morning.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Happy to have you join us. Again, 866-733-6786. Join us now with your tax questions. We are going to try to get through as many tax questions as we can over the next 50-some minutes or so. Let's start out by just talking about the nature of what people are pressed with right now, because everything came out later this year, Jesse Weller, with the fiscal cliff. Forms came out later. How much of a problem is that causing because we didn't get the information or we're getting information in a more compressed manner?
Well, the late tax legislation did delay the opening of the filing season. We started accepting electronic returns on January 30th, which was a little bit later than normal. Also, the late legislation caused us to have to upgrade our computers, reprogram, and change the forms at the last minute because there were several changes that affected the 2012 tax returns and tax forms. So,
and how is that playing out with your filers, Bob Kaplan? What kind of problems is this posing?
Well, our whole tax season got compressed. As a matter of fact, we couldn't file most of our tax returns until the first week of March because the forms weren't available, except for the very straightforward clients.
And does that mean that people are sort of in hurry-up mode and may not be taking advantage or looking carefully enough at the kinds of deductions that they have available?
Yeah, that would be a mistake because you do have an opportunity of an extension of 6 months. The requirement is you have to pay 90% of the tax liability by April 15th. There is a new ruling that came out from the IRS with some relief for late payment penalties if one of the forms that just got released affects your return, but generally you need to make sure you have an accurate return even if you go on extension.
Let's get right to our questions. Eric has our first tax question this morning. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, I formed an LLC in August of 2012 for a short film project that I was making, but I had no financial transactions, no income, no expenses directly out of the LLC. Do I need to file a tax return?
Bob Kaplan.
Are you the only owner, Eric?
No, my wife is also on it.
Okay. That's considered to be a single-member LLC in California, which is also known as a disregarded entity. There's a form you have to file, and you also have to pay $800 a year, but the income goes directly on your tax return. So California just collects the toll tax of $800, but you report all the income as a Schedule C on your own return.
Does that answer your question, Eric?
So I guess it would be, when I file my personal taxes, I would use that as a deduction?
Yes.
Okay. So I do need to file one?
Yes.
Okay. And if I formed it in Nevada, not California, does that make a difference?
Well, that makes life more interesting. The Franchise Tax Board has a position that if the management of the LLC is in California, if you filed a foreign LLC, such as Nevada, you have to register with California, and you're right back where you started from, paying $800.
Okay.
And Eric, thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, let me ask.
First of all, I'm glad to know that officially, according to the IRS, Nevada counts as a foreign territory. Is that right? All right. Jeff Smiler, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask Bob that. My understanding is that if you haven't received any income, it's possible that this business hasn't actually started and got off the ground, that it's more in the exploratory phase. And I'm wondering if you can take deductions in that kind of case.
Well, you're talking about not the LLC, but the Schedule C. So if assuming you have a flow-through entity, so you're reporting everything on your own tax return, if you're in a startup phase, I think there's a $5,000 deduction you can take for startup expenses, but you may be in a position where you're what's known as capitalizing your costs until you're in operation.
And can you only do that if you are formally set up as an LLC, that startup deduction?
I think it applies to any Schedule C.
It does apply to any type of small business like that, but the main thing is that you have to be able to show that you've started the business before you start deducting those expenses.
Martha is next in San Francisco. Martha, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about – I have previous tax penalties. I'm on automated payments with the IRS, and I'm paying monthly, but I don't see my total amount going any shorter because with all these penalties that I owe, I feel that I'm just paying for the penalties and not for the – amount that I owe to the IRS.
Okay, let's get an explanation of how payback works with this. Sounds like Martha's paying penalties, but she's not maybe working off the amount she owes?
Well, actually, it works a little bit different than that. When you're on an installment agreement to pay back taxes, at least to the federal, the money that you pay is applied first to the tax that you owe, and then after all the tax is paid, then you begin to pay off the penalty and interest charges. So there should be a balance reduction when you see your invoice or your statement that shows how your balance is calculated, and that should go down. Although, you know, depending upon how high the bill is, those penalties and interest can be high because it is interest is charged on a daily basis and the penalties are like a 0.25% a month.
And Bob Kaplan, how seriously should people worry about the penalty factor? I mean, and how do you best avoid them? If you can't pay everything, it sounds like in Martha's situation, do you just pay something? Does that reduce the penalty? How can you minimize the future damage that you would incur?
Well, the IRS uses penalties as a way of generating revenue, and there's all sorts of penalties. The most common ones are estimated tax penalties where you don't pay enough during the year, late filing and late payment penalties where you don't pay enough by April 15th that we're coming up to, and there's other penalties. There's a 20% accuracy penalty if you get caught or you have an adjustment. So really, that's why I said at the beginning, you're better off filing an accurate return even if you have to go on extension, because if you take wild guesses and you're short and you have to correct it when you're filing an extended return, you're going to be subject to penalty.
Martha, thanks for the call. Kevin is next in San Francisco. Kevin.
Howdy. I like to fill out forms and play by the rules. And ever since I became self-employed, I've always noticed that I have to play this game with the IRS that I cannot get an answer to, which is that each profession has allowed deductions. And there's a term of art that they'll say, which is accepted practice, I think, or common practice or in your profession what the norm is. I don't want to play that game. I just want a list of what are the permitted deductions that I could follow and not be concerned that this is permitted or not permitted or they can challenge that or not challenge that. And I do not understand why each profession that they diligently coordinate with a number and say this is who you are, this is what you do, cannot have a list of permitted deductions.
And Kevin, again, what is your profession?
I have a very obscure profession. I manage a magician.
Okay.
For an entertainment business.
Okay.
Ash K,
all right.
A local magician, Ash K.
Yeah. All right. So
did you say you manage a magician?
Yes. And
okay.
I also teach after school magic classes.
Well, so, managing a professional or an entertainer is a pretty common practice. But let me first say something, and then I'm sure Bob can chime in as well. When the laws are created, in this case, there's a law about what is deductible for a business under Code Section 162. And it basically uses the term ordinary and necessary. The reason why the law is so general is because it does cover all types of businesses. And generally, the laws don't get specific unless there's a reason for Congress to enact that law and for it to be signed into law. So ordinary and necessary is the standard that we have to go by because that's what's in the law. There are some common things that are listed in Publication 535 on business expenses, and it does list common things for many businesses. There is no law that I know of that covers every type of business, and certainly it doesn't get into specifics for certain types. So we don't have the kind of list you're looking for.
But I think, I mean, if I understand Kevin's point generally, there is always a certain amount of, well, let's see, I work in journalism, so can I deduct a percentage of my newspaper subscriptions? I mean, why not have a more precise guide? If you're in this profession, you can deduct 30% of your professional subscriptions or 50% or 80% or whatever.
I understand the point, but where do you stop? If you were to create lists, what industry do you leave off the list? And what industries do you include, and then why do you leave them off, if you see my point?
But Kevin, back to you for a sec. Do you have a specific deduction that you'd like to ask about whether or not it's allowable?
No, I sure don't. But this is exactly my point. They have the IRS has the resources to give us good instructions about how to do everything but this. And I understand that there are many, many professions. But I understand also that it's an enormous, almost 100-year-old bureaucracy, and I can make lists of things. It's not that hard. But it puts the taxpayer, who's trying to be a law-abiding citizen and stay out of trouble, in this awkward position of this guessing game, which I find intensely unpleasant and in 2013 unnecessary.
Kevin,
give
thanks.
Give us a list.
Yeah, okay. Bob Kaplan, on this point of how you calculate and don't take unnecessary chances, and try to be, you were advocating being as accurate as you can, but it's tough to be accurate if you're not sure exactly what's allowable.
Well, when we have a client come in, we ask them to put everything down, and we go over how it relates to their business. Let's take travel, for example. I have some clients that have tremendous amounts of travel because they have to visit companies that they consult with. Other clients basically work in their home and have no travel. Every business is different, and you have to go over and understand the business in determining what are ordinary and necessary business expenses. So the best thing is to go with a tax professional, and my clients come in all the time. Here are 10 things. Can I deduct these? And we talk about them.
And we do define what ordinary and necessary means. It's not just two words on a page. And it's what's accepted and what's normal for that type of activity.
And again, Jesswell, if people want to get that definition and double check it against what they're planning to deduct, how do they find out that information?
Publication 535 has information about business expenses.
And just go to the IRS website and look up Publication
535. Correct. IRS.gov has lots of information, including other web pages that go into detail.
866-733-6786 is our number. We're going to take as many tax questions as we can for the rest of our hour. You can email them to us forum@kqed.org or post them on our Facebook page or on our website. Mike in Napa has our next tax question. Mike, go ahead.
So in 2011, I owed the state of California taxes that weren't, I wasn't deducting it at the correct amount. And so when I was going through and doing my taxes this year, I saw some language like on TurboTax or something like that said if you paid a tax debt to like a locality or a state in the 2012 calendar year that was deductible from your federal return under an itemized deduction. Is that true?
Yeah, that's
Bob Kaplan?
That's right. If you paid any year's deficiency to California in calendar year 2012, the check was written that year, you get to deduct it in 12.
Okay.
All right, Mike, thanks for the call. Here's another question about when you can deduct something or make up for a deduction not taken in the past. This person writes, when I divorced 6 years ago, I did not know that I could itemize, perhaps she means deduct, the legal costs. Can I now amend my current return to get that deduction?
Well, two bad things about that situation. One is that generally, if you make a mistake, whether it's in your favor or not, if it's in your favor, you have generally 3 years to file an amended return to claim that refund. If, in this case, you're talking about deducting legal fees for a divorce, generally that's not deductible.
Oh, okay.
So, well, there could be a portion of legal fees that would be deductible if they relate to spousal support type issues. Another portion of the legal fees can be tacked onto an asset. But unfortunately, you have to deduct it in the year you write the check.
No, generally it's not deductible, but you're right. You can deduct legal fees when it's associated with getting taxable income, which alimony is taxable.
And the key window here is 3 years. So if you've made a mistake, you've got 3 years to correct
right.
it. Okay. All right. Thanks for that. Peter asks, if my wife and I purchase a house for our daughter and collect rent from her for living in the house, can we deduct the mortgage interest from our federal taxes, and can we depreciate the purchase costs of the house as a business expense? So buying a house for a child, can you deduct that on your own taxes?
Well, the question is, who owns the house? Does the daughter own the house? Then you can't deduct anything. If you're an owner or a part owner of the house, you can fill out a Schedule E, which is a rental schedule. You should have something approaching fair market rent from your daughter, not a dollar a month, and then you're eligible for all those deductions.
Here's another house question. Rebecca writes, I purchased a home in June of 2005, and when I married, I moved out in 2010. I rented the home for 6 months in 2010 and in 2012. I had the home foreclosed upon in 2012. The house was at least $200,000 underwater. Is there a tax implication for me? I owed about $300,000 on the home. Here's a lot of numbers there. I'm going to slide this over to you.
Well, the first issue is something called relief of indebtedness. When the lender issues a Form 1099-C for relief of indebtedness, that means you were underwater in a foreclosure or a short sale. The default is that's taxable income, which is sort of bad news. You've lost the house. Your credit score has been knocked down, and the default is you have to pay this tax. There are exceptions to that. There's three primary ones. One's bankruptcy, one's insolvency, which requires calculation, and the other is a specific relief for a type of principal residence. So you really need to see a tax professional on this. I do a lot of work in this area, and a lot of times we can save the client a big tax bill.
And to Joe in Palo Alto. Joe, go ahead. Joe, you're on the air. Can you go ahead with your question?
Yes, yes. I'm just calling about the 1098-T form, please.
And what is your question about the 1098-T?
I have a son that goes to the UC system.
And your question is?
Well, I called the IRS, and they tell me there are qualified and non-qualified expenses. I don't know what that means.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So, Jess Weller.
The IRS does have a good publication you should check on our website. It's publication 970 that deals with education expenses. And it lists what's qualified and what's not and what type of education qualifies for this credit. It's called the American Opportunity Tax Credit. There's also a lifetime learning credit. And either one can be claimed in a given year for the same expenses. And you usually get a good benefit off the American Opportunity Tax Credit.
Can you give us a snapshot, Jess Weller, of sort of what kinds of higher education expenses are deductible?
Well, generally, it would be expenses associated with higher education, like a college or university, and also some other types of higher learning educational
institutions.
Tuition and fees and other related fees for course-related, like books and supplies that you have to purchase. But one thing you want to remember is that if you get the benefit of the credit, that's one thing, and then you can also give up the benefit to your child if it's to their benefit, if they're working.
And again, the publication?
Publication 970.
Okay. So, Joe, go find publication 970, and it should answer your question.
Let me add one thing to the other question, too, on foreclosure. When you do have a foreclosure, you have to report that similar to a sale. And that's in addition to the cancellation of debt income that Bob was referring to.
Elnora in Albany has our next question. Elnora?
Hi. I have a cottage that I rent out to vacationers. I also offer a week in that cottage to my hospital to auction off as a fundraiser, and my accounting professional says I cannot deduct the cost, the normal cost of that week. Is that true?
I'm afraid that's true. Because you didn't receive the revenue from it, so you can't offset it. It's a nice thing to do, but you don't get a tax break for it.
Yeah, looking at it is the good news is that you are doing something good. The bad news is you didn't get any income, so you can't take that write-off.
Any other things that we ought to
update people on in terms of charitable deductions? Anything changing in that arena? What are the standards? How much do you have to have before it can be deducted? What do you have to reach? That kind of thing. Bob Kaplan?
Well, I'm seeing a little more activity on the audit of charitable donations. For example, non-cash contributions like Goodwill Salvation Army, there are now rules of thumb you can get from the Salvation Army website, which are closer worth. And taking a punt on that is now could cause you a problem with penalties and interest. As far as cash and check donations, you need to get a receipt on all of them, but I believe it's $250. It's mandatory.
Yeah, you do need records of all cash donations, whether it's a bank check, receipt, or a statement from the organization. The other thing is, too, when you're donating clothes and household items, they have to be in good condition or better.
And the threshold is you have to have a certain, what is it, 5,000? What is it, the amount that you have to reach before deducting makes more sense than taking the standard deduction? You've got to add up both in charitable and mortgage amounts a certain amount. So
right.
For many people, it's not necessarily going to be the route that they would want to travel.
Right. Your itemized deductions total, to be a benefit, need to exceed your standard deduction. For a single person in 2012, it's $5,950.
And to Frank in Palo Alto. Frank, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. The question is in regards to investment accounts. So I understand that you can use a IRA account or a self-directed IRA account to basically turn it into an LLC and do investments into commercial real estate. I wanted to know what is the limit amount that someone can contribute towards the yearly contribution towards the IRA account, and is there a total limit?
Okay, Frank, complicated question. You've got it. This has to do with both whether you can transfer it and what the limits are.
Well, I can address the limits. The limit generally is $5,000 that you can contribute, and if you're age 50 or over, is it? Then you can do up to $6,000 to contribute, and that's limited basically by your earned income. If you have wages or self-employment earnings, that kind of earned income where you're working, that's your basic limitation. So if you're making over $5,000, you can deduct that you can contribute that $5,000.
And Frank, the other part of your question is, can you use some of your IRA to fund other enterprises? Is that right?
From what I've spoken to attorneys and colleagues, the understanding is that we can create a investment account such as an IRA account, and then we can turn that account into a corporation LLC, and we can use those funds to basically invest into properties. And I work in the commercial real estate sector.
Okay.
So basically the question is, how much is the limit, which is $5,000 per year, I understand, correct?
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Frank.
So that's called a self-directed IRA, and there are specific provisions on that. You have to have an administrator that deals in that area, and it's done primarily with real estate-type investments and also with deeds of trust. One of the detriments of that is you don't get the tax benefits out of real estate. There are a number of clients have it.
And we'll fill in with a little bit more detail when we return, but we've got to take a short break. Again, call us at 866-733-6786. If you have a tax question, our phone lines are full, but we will get to as many as we can in the hour ahead. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your questions or thoughts on our Facebook page or on our website. We've asked and answered 13 questions. We're going to try to get to 50 by the end of the hour. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, tax questions. We're going to try to provide answers to as many questioners as we can. See if we can get to 50 questions in 50 minutes. 866-733-6786 is our number. Let's go next to Alex. Alex in Mountain View, your question, please.
Hello. Yes, I am in the position of accepting a W-2 contract position in Texas, and I live in California. The contracting agency is in Texas, and so is the company I'd be working for. I would have to travel back and forth between California and Texas to come back home and also rent a temporary apartment out there. As a W-2 contractor, is there any tax deduction I can take, or would I have to be 1099 for that?
Alex, thanks.
Well, when you say W-2 contractor, you're talking about two different things. If they're going to give you a W-2, then you're an employee. If you're an independent contractor, you get a 1099.
So which are you, Alex? Are you an employee?
I am accepting a position with a contracting agency who contracts me out to a company, and I would be a W-2 employee to that agency. But in doing so, I would need to have a temporary apartment out there and travel back and forth between there and home.
Yeah,
and
got
how,
it.
How long is this going to last?
6 to 12 months.
Okay.
So your expenses as an employee go on Schedule A, itemized deduction, miscellaneous section, as an employee business expense. A are expenses that are deductible because you're not reimbursed by your employer and they're necessary to your job, such as living in Texas. There are limitations on miscellaneous deductions. First, they have to exceed 2% of your income, and then if you're lucky enough to be subject to alternative minimum tax, they don't help you at all.
But it sounds like this is an important point to be clear about. Those sorts of – because I had the same – I would have had the same question as Alex had, that I would have thought those only were deductible if you were doing that as an independent contractor. But those are still deductible even if you're an employee.
If you're not reimbursed by the employer.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Alex?
Yes, I wouldn't be reimbursed, but I understand it has to exceed 2% of my income then.
Yeah. All right. Alex, thanks so much. Yeah, Amy in San Francisco is next. You want to fill in more, Jeff?
Well, I was just going to say that there's one other thing, too. He was asking about the expense of living, like the rent for a temporary housing and also the travel. The housing might qualify because it is a temporary location and his tax home is not in the other location. But the travel back home, for example, for personal reasons, might not qualify because it's not a business expense.
I'm going to count that as two questions in my tally here.
Okay.
Since we gave follow-up information.
That's a good idea.
Amy in San Francisco, you're next. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, a relative from Europe would like to send me a gift, of a large gift, $700,000. And I just would like to know what are the implications for me in the United States as I receive that money, that gift.
That's all good news.
Sounds great to me.
Yeah. A gift that you receive is generally tax-free no matter what the size is. The main thing you'll want to do is to get evidence and proof from the giver as to why they're giving you this money. Because if you ever get asked, where did you get the money, you want to be able to prove it was a gift that you received just out of the goodness of wherever they gave it to you.
And here's my follow-up question to Amy's, which is I thought there was a gift that you could only give like $13,000 or $14,000 or something. Sounds like Amy is getting considerably more than that.
That's when you're the giver. When you're the recipient, there's no limit.
Yeah, it is a big confusion because the gift tax is on the giver, not the recipient. It's to make sure that people don't try to give away all their estate before they pass.
Probably my relative in Europe that is giving me the money would have to deal with some tax. Or some other
probably paperwork. Possibly from their country, but the IRS or the U.S. government wouldn't be involved with their taxes.
So good news for Amy. All right. Thanks, Amy, for the call.
Thank you.
Dennis in Santa Fe joins us next. Dennis.
Good morning. I got a corrected form from my stockbroker with dividends after I filed, and my CPA tells me that it would be $50 to my benefit, but he'd have to charge me $200 to send in a corrected form. If I don't owe any taxes and I get a corrected return, do I have to amend my return?
Well, we have a rule in our office first of all, I want to say that these corrected 1099s are a major problem. Mm-hmm. First of all, the brokers went to the IRS and said, if you give us till February 15th, we'll issue them once and never correct them. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So the corrected 1099s, our rule is if it doesn't change your tax by $100, we don't do an amended return, and we've never gotten a billing from the IRS for that amount under $100.
Dennis, thanks. Thanks for the call. Pat asks, I started getting my Social Security in February of this year, but I turned 66 last year, and I decided to retroactively receive benefits. So February of this year, I received $8,000 in benefits for 2012, starting in August. I haven't gotten a 1099, though, for those 2012 benefits. So now what do I do?
Yeah, you won't get a 1099 for the 2012 amount that was paid in 2013. It will all go on your 1099 SSA for 2013. The good news is that when you get a retroactive check, and many people do get that retroactive check that might be a very large amount. You can do a special calculation for 2013 when you file, and Publication 915, which deals with Social Security benefits, that's Publication 915, that does talk about these kinds of retro checks or very large lump sum payments is what it's called.
What about people, Jess, who are retiring this year, taking Social Security? What about the earned income? If you're once you start getting benefits, you can only make so much money if you are retiring before your full retirement age, right?
Yeah, those are Social Security benefit rules of where you might be subject to certain limits on how much you can make before they reduce your benefits. I'm not an expert on Social Security benefits, so.
And let's go to Anthony next in San Francisco. Anthony.
Yeah, hi, this is Anthony Flanagan. I am from San Francisco. I've lived here all my life. I'm a citizen of America. However, for the last 2 years, I've lived in China. I have an ongoing business there, an open-end contract. I have a long-term home there. My tax home is in China. And I understand the physical presence test for the federal government. So I only come back every 35 days per year. So my question is, I understand there's another test that may allow me to actually come back to the U.S. for a longer period called the bona fide resident test. And I'm wondering how that works and what the rules are for how long you can stay in the U.S. And secondly is state residency after now 2 years of living in China, and only being in the California for 35 days a year, do I qualify to not pay my California state tax?
Okay. Anthony, thanks. Bob Kaplan.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to answer the first part.
Sure.
And I'll let you answer the hard part. The Publication 54 does go into the bona fide residence test and the physical presence test that the caller mentioned. And so you want to get Publication 54. It deals with U.S. citizens and residents of the U.S. abroad.
And is the question here is, if I understand you right, Anthony, whether or not you're subject to certain – if you are here for longer than that amount, you want to only be here a certain number of days because otherwise you'd be subject to certain tax consequences. Is that right?
That's right. I get a tax credit for being – living abroad. But frankly, I'd like to be here more than 35 days.
Okay.
Here.
So Bob Kaplan.
What it is, it's a exclusion of income up to $95,100. But you can get a portion of that depending on the number of days that you're out of the United States. And there also is a housing allowance. There's very technical rules for this. But you can have a significant amount of your income not subject to U.S. tax, and the amount that is could also be subject to a foreign tax credit because you're paying tax maybe in another country. It depends on every situation is different. Now, as the Franchise Tax Board goes, they like to think you're a resident. The question is, we have a checklist in our office of 20 items in which the Franchise Tax Board will try to establish that you're a California resident. I don't have time to go through all of those, but when you have a connection to California, residence, bank accounts, securities accounts, there's many others, California is going to tax you.
Okay. Anthony, thanks for the question. Francis writes in, can you discuss medical deductions for living in a senior facility due to dementia or other illness?
Well, it sounds like if you're there for a medical reason that those expenses, those costs might be deductible or would be deductible. Problem with medical expenses in general is this year for 2012, you need to make sure that those expenses exceed 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. And I believe that goes up for 2013 to 10%.
Not if you're over 65, though. It's still 7.5%.
Okay.
But if you're living in a assisted nursing facility of some sort, almost certainly those expenses are going to exceed 7% of your income.
It's very, very possible depending upon the level of income. And if it's for medical reasons, if someone is in a home and it's not for medical reasons, the medical portion of the cost while you're there would still be deductible, but not necessarily all the living expenses.
Mary Lou asks, I support my grown daughter 100% due to her being too ill to work. Can I deduct this?
Assuming she has no income or under the threshold, which is something like $4,900 or something, you can claim her as a dependent.
even though she's of adult age?
Yes.
For 2012, it's $3,800 is the gross income limit. This is for somebody that's over 18.
To Adam in Kensington. Adam.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question about figuring out cost basis for stocks that were purchased 20 or more years ago, and I'm really having trouble finding the original documentation for that original purchase price.
So starting in 2011, the IRS required the brokers to establish and report what cost basis is. But before that time, there was no necessarily a tracking mechanism to determine what the cost basis is, particularly something from 20 years ago. Now, there are services you can get on the web to try to go back and reestablish what your cost basis is. And you can also check what reinvested dividends are, because when you get a reinvested dividend, you're actually buying more stocks, so you get more basis. But when push comes to shove, you're probably going to have to take a intelligent guess.
Yeah, so there are some areas where an intelligent guess is okay? You don't have to have records for everything?
Well, if you don't have the record, what you want is, as Bob said, a reasonable estimate of what your basis is. And it might fly if you get asked to prove what your cost basis is. And there are services, as Bob indicated, on the web to reconstruct what the purchase price might have been on a given date. The more information you have to prove when you got the stock and what it was worth at that time, because you can find that out if it's publicly traded. If it's not publicly traded, you might have a very difficult time establishing.
This raises a question probably a lot of people want to know, which is, how do I avoid getting audited? What are the kinds of things that are sort of red flags to your agency, Jeff?
One quick red flag, and this is the main one for us, is that you report all your income, because the IRS does get reports of income from information returns like W-2s and 1099s. And if you don't report all your income, you're going to get notified from us. And so that's one way to avoid a red flag.
There's different kinds of audits. There's something called a CP2000 or correspondence audit, which takes about a year after the return is filed, and the IRS gets all the information from brokers, banks, and says, you didn't report this. And then you get to say, no, I did report it, or I owe, or I don't owe. The other is what I call the come on down audit, where they want you to come to the office, and they're usually looking at, in my experience, things like rental properties or Schedule C or business income and expense. Now, one thing I got to stress is reporting all your income. Another thing I got to stress is if you have a business, that your gross receipts match your bank statements. As far as the deductions go, we can go into that, but please have the total amount of income shown on your tax return. That's the worst thing you can do.
And lastly, don't be afraid of an audit if you file an honest and accurate return. All an audit is an accounting procedure, and as Bob will tell you, that's what he does for a living, and if you don't go to a professional, just make sure you have the records and you do an accurate return.
Peter in San Francisco has a Social Security question. Peter, go ahead.
Yeah, is Social Security considered ordinary income and taxable? And if that's your main or only income and you have maybe some additional bank accounts or other sorts of small incomes, what do you even have to file?
Well, there is a different filing requirement based upon your filing or marital status. And Social Security is taxable for people at a lower income level. 50% of it could be taxed up to $34,000 for most people. Over $34,000, you're in an 85% of your Social Security would be taxable or could be taxable. As far as the filing requirement, if it's your only source of income, you don't have to file a return. If you have other income, you really need to look at what the total is when you take half your Social Security and add it to your other income to see if you meet the filing thresholds, which are listed either on IRS.gov or in the instruction book.
So if you have, let's say, one retirement fund, you have a pension from where you used to work, and you have Social Security, and it all adds up to greater than the threshold, still even then, only a portion of your Social Security is taxable?
Correct. And generally, if you're low income, like I said, under $34,000, 50% of it would be reported, but not more than that, and it could go up to 85%.
Peter, thanks. Joseph writes in, what if I haven't filed taxes in 5 years, and I also don't make more than $10,000 a year?
Well, I would think the best thing to do is to call up the IRS the main number, which I believe is 1-800-829-1040, and ask for a transcript and see what they have there. Now, the problem is this. I had this yesterday. When you sell stock, the IRS shows as income the total sales price. They don't know what your cost basis is, and they may think that you have to file a tax return even though your income is under $10,000. So the best way is to get a transcript and see what they have.
Keith writes in, can you clarify the usage of the term write-off versus deduction?
Well, I think that's the same thing.
It is the same thing.
All right. And he also asks, when discussing taxes in a context with friends, I find these terms not used consistently. So, but it sounds like from what you're saying that it's a distinction without a difference. So
right.
for tax purposes, they're one and the same.
There is a difference between deduction and credit. A deduction is from income and a credit reduces your tax.
Mark asks, what are the typical mistakes made by people who use consumer tax software like TurboTax, and can you rely on them? Good question to ask you, Bob.
Well, I would think that once your return has a certain level of complexity, you should go to a professional. And of course, I would recommend a CPA. We get TurboTax returns all the time from new clients with pretty bad errors in there. There's something, I guess, I've never actually used TurboTax, but at some point you think you're done and you press the button and you file a terrible return.
So be careful. Avijit has our next question in San Francisco. Avijit, go ahead.
Oh, hi. I have a question about what status should I apply, when I file my tax return as a new resident, as a new green card holder in 2013.
So you're a new green card holder as of this year?
Yeah.
And so the question is whether or not you need to file taxes for 2012 as a new resident?
Yeah. Do I file taxes as a resident or as a non-resident? In fact, we'll be filing jointly this year.
Okay. Bob?
My wife's an American citizen, so that she should be filing as a resident, obviously. But I just want to know if I should be filing as a resident. Because this is crucial, because if I do file as a non-resident, immigration could come and tell me, like, oh, you filed as a non-resident, so you're no longer a resident.
Once you cross over to a green card, you file a 1040 as opposed to a 1040 NR, which is for a non-resident alien. You have a choice of filing joint or separate with your wife, but it sounds like you're both going to file a 1040 regular return. Now, of course, if you have foreign income, like I said earlier, you could be subject to a foreign tax credit or foreign earned income exclusion. But the basic rule is once you get that green card, you report all your worldwide income.
But I think he said he got his green card in 2013. So in 2012, I think it might also depend upon the number of days or the time period that he was in the United States. And it may be to your benefit to file as married filing joint and declare your worldwide income on your U.S. return with your wife as a resident rather than a non-resident return for 2012.
Does that give you the answer you need, Avijit?
It looks like it. So I'll be filing as a resident. So that's
okay. All right. Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. Kathy writes, we hired a housekeeper to come in every other week to clean our house. She spends 3 to 4 hours cleaning. She also works for other individuals. She does not live with us. Would we consider her an employee or an independent contractor?
Well, this is one of the ones that goes off the radar screen. We generally ask our clients to get a W-2 if they're going to take this person as a medical deduction or if it relates to the child tax credit, but rarely for a cleaner.
And to Bill in Petaluma. Bill.
Yes, I'm just calling concerning a foreign income question as well. My wife is a green card holder, and she has a percentage ownership in businesses of her family in Mexico, and we're basically wondering about how that should be taxed. My CPA asked for me to get a second opinion on how much she makes. About $1,100 a month from that percent ownership.
Yeah, she definitely needs to report worldwide income as a green card holder or a resident of the United States. Citizens and residents of the U.S. need to report worldwide income regardless of where they live. And so if you're in the United States and getting foreign income, you definitely need to report it. And I think your accountant is probably recommending that you contact the business in Mexico to make sure that they report the amount, the proper amount that you received as well.
Okay, Bill?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Here's a timely question. Lauren writes, my husband and I are a legally married same-sex couple. For our federal returns, we've been adding our income and each claiming half. If DOMA is declared unconstitutional, will we be entitled to amend our returns and file as a married couple?
Well, I can't answer that because we're talking about something that may or may not happen, and the IRS really doesn't speculate about what might happen in the future. So I can only state the way it is, and this person probably already knows the way it is.
Mani asks, do we need to report profit and loss on tax-free municipal bonds? Bob?
There could actually be a capital gain on muni bonds, and you actually could have, by the way, California income on muni bonds if they're out of state. So the answer is yes.
Here's another question about household help and your tax liabilities in that regard. Sandy has a question calling in from Sunnyvale. Sandy?
Yes, hi. I am a nanny working for a family that does not want to pay taxes for me. So they are paying me by check, but they don't want to deduct anything. So I would like to be self-employed, pay my own taxes and worry about, you know, paying my own Medicare and Social Security, I guess, at this point. But is it possible to file and not include them or not have to name them?
If you report your income as a self-employed person, you don't have to list the source of your income on your return. It may be that they should be giving you a W-2 and paying Social Security and Medicare tax as an employee. But if you report it as a self-employed person, just to understand that you're paying almost double of what you normally would as an employee.
Sandy, thank you. What are the rules on that? When does someone count as an employee?
Well, there are different rules for household employees. And for example, if you hire somebody and let's say they do gardening work or they do lawn cutting work, if they just come by and they use their own equipment and they do everybody's lawn in the neighborhood, that might be an independent contractor and they're not your employee. If you have a nanny or you have a housekeeper, whether they live with you or not, it could be that they are a household employee. There are certain dollar limits on the amount of cash wages that you pay each year before they're considered a household employee that you have to withhold Social Security and Medicare tax.
Kim asks, is there a way that my parents can gift their house to me with minimal tax consequences?
Well, you've got two different animals there. You've got gift tax and you've got income tax. And we get asked this question a lot, particularly at the end of last year when the estate tax was in limbo. If they give it to you, they have to get an appraisal of the house, and because they're giving you something worth more than $14,000, they have to file a gift tax return. Basically, this is a reporting requirement. However, you get their tax problem, and they may qualify for an exclusion as a principal residence because they've lived in there for a long time, and you don't. So you have to do some careful planning there.
Brian writes in, I'm self-employed. Did the 2% payroll tax cut in 2012 also apply to self-employed individuals?
Yes.
Yes, it did.
And second question, would TurboTax pick up that deduction?
Yes, it would.
I don't know.
let me say this. It's very important for people to understand that e-file is a very good program. In fact, you can file for free using the IRS.gov website. Using free files, so anyone can use that. And when you're using software, if you put garbage in, you might get a bad return out. And so if there are errors, it's not a math error or some kind of calculation error or forgetting to put the right forms on your return. But when you're going through the interview process, if you don't answer the questions properly, you're going to get a bad return. So realize that, you know, over a billion returns have been filed safely and securely through e-file, and you should use FreeFile if you want to do it for free.
And also point out, if you would, Jess Weller, where people who are of lower income can get assistance in preparing their taxes.
Yeah. Use the IRS.gov website and type in the word volunteers, and you're going to get volunteers for people with low incomes and also seniors that can have their taxes done for free. Let me also say regarding e-file that when a person has a complicated return and it's not easily prepared and they can't invest the time to do their own taxes, they may want to see a professional. And certainly, depending upon the complexity, going to an enrolled agent, a CPA, or an attorney is a wise thing. And more than 60% of the population does use some kind of professional help.
Squeeze in one more question. Darren in Sunnyvale, real quickly, please.
Hi, yeah, my question is about selling property and taking the primary residence capital gains exclusion. I recently sold a property. It used to be my primary residence. I moved because of a new job that's closer to my new property and proceeded to rent out my old property for the last 4 years. So I've only lived in it for 1 out of 5 years, so I don't automatically meet the rule. However, I'm wondering if I can argue under the exception in publication 529 that I did move and ultimately sell the property because of a new job.
Okay, Darren, thanks. Bob?
First of all, if you meet the test, a portion of the gain is going to be taxable for the period after, I believe, 2009 when it was a rental. Now, there is an exception. There are exceptions for not being in the house for 2 out of 5 years. The bottom line, the one you're talking about, is either a change in job or unforeseen circumstances. And you'd have to go through the rules and regulations and cases and see whether you met that test.
Yeah, and it is publication 523, not 529.
And here's just a last one from a listener about keeping track of deductions in terms of goodwill. They want to know how risky that is. We touched on this briefly, but is that something where you have to be really careful about? Is that an invitation to audit if you put down that you gave too much to goodwill or donated too many items?
They have on their website a value of practically everything. That's what we tell clients to use. Just attach that to the receipt.
And we answered 5, 10, 15, 40 questions over the last hour. Didn't get quite to my goal, but pretty good. Bob Goldman, thanks so much for being part of our program. Jess Weller, thanks too very
much.
Forum is produced today by Susan Britton and Tina Lorberg. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Amanda Stupai is our engagement producer. Dan Zoll, our senior editor. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.